And we continue with the disclosure initiative.
Good afternoon, everyone. So we are here to talk about the board's targeted standards level review of disclosures. By way of reminder on where we are within this project, in May, June and July of this year, the board made tentative decisions about the approach that it would take when developing and drafting disclosure requirements in future. We're referring to that as the guidance for the board. In July, then, the board decided to test that guidance by applying it to IAS 19 and IFRS 13. Over the summer, since that meeting, we've been very much engaged in planning that testing. And the purpose of today's meeting is to give the board an opportunity to see all of the guidance for the board together in one paper, so that we can see if you have any additional thoughts or comments to add as we embark on the testing process. A couple of points that I wanted to highlight for context with this meeting. The first one is that where you note within today's paper differences or additions beyond what you saw in May, June and July, they all came about as a consequence of feedback that we had during those three board meetings or as a consequence of other feedback, for example, discussing this topic with ASAF in the July consultative group meeting. The other point that I wanted to highlight was that we very much at this stage see the approach in today's paper as an approach for testing. It's not set in stone yet, and we anticipate that we will learn a lot over the coming months and come up with ways that we can further improve and refine it, and that is a big part of the objective of the testing process. So with all of that context in mind, I will hand over to Siobhan for paper 11A.
Okay, so in the May, June and July 2018 board meetings, the board developed a draft framework to use when developing and drafting disclosure objectives and requirements in future. This framework is intended to firstly help the board develop more specific and effective disclosure objectives, thereby encouraging preparers to exercise judgment when deciding what to disclose. Secondly, to improve the process by which the board develops the content of disclosure objectives and requirements. And finally, to encourage the board to communicate more effectively with stakeholders by improving the process the board uses when drafting disclosure objectives and requirements. So the draft framework can be summarized in three steps as listed in paragraph four. The first step explains how the board will use disclosure objectives and has been summarized in paragraphs 5 to 12. In its May 2018 meeting, the board tentatively decided to explicitly state the objective of each disclosure requirement and clearly link each requirement with the related objective. In addition, high-level catch-all disclosure objectives within individual standards will be used to prompt entities preparing financial statements to consider as a whole the disclosure relating to a topic and whether the information provided meets user information needs. The second step explains how the board will develop the content of disclosure objectives and requirements and has been summarized in paragraphs 13 to 40. In its June 2018 meeting, the board tentatively decided that when developing disclosure objectives and requirements, a member of the IFRS taxonomy team be assigned to each of the board's active projects in an advisory capacity. In addition, a focused methodology has been drafted to develop the content of disclosure objectives and requirements. And this methodology has been explained in paragraphs 17 to 40. The third and final step explains how the board will draft disclosure objectives and requirements and has been summarised in paragraphs 41 to 58. In its July 2018 meeting, the board tentatively decided that effective communication can be addressed through the use of language, formatting and presentation of disclosure objectives and requirements within IFRS standards, and leveraging and guidance across IFRS standards and other IFRS publications. So our question for the board today is the board happy with the draft guidance for the board to use when developing and drafting disclosure objectives and requirements? And if not, what additional changes would you like us to make? Thank you. Oh, you heard that.
Thank you. So overall, I'm very happy with the draft guidance, and I'm pleased to see it brought together in one place after our deliberations. Just three observations, really. Just to be cognizant that as we talk about the guidance, sometimes it's expressed in terms of how it will apply to an existing standard, but this is also applicable to new standards and how we devise disclosures for those as well. So a nuance, really, within that. The second point, which I think comes in paragraph 27, right at the end, 27E, which is differentiating between must-have and nice-to-have information. And this is absolutely critical. I took it upon myself one afternoon recently to take one of our test standards and work through it. I won't tell you which information I found helpful or not. But I really had to question myself. When was the last, not was, is this just a must-have or nice-to-have, but when was the last time did I use this piece of information? Have I ever used this piece of information? And I know you have some techniques planned to ask about how the information is used to try and eke that out, but I think that's a critical element of the process. And the third element is talking about, I guess, the outreach, and just, this may be prejudice, but I also think it's experience, and that is, I think sell-side and buy-side analysts operate differently. Sell-side, by their very nature, are specialists. They have a much larger appetite for information. It's almost their job to know everything about a company, whereas on the buy-side, you're trying to work out what really matters. You're trying to get to those material factors. So I'm not saying you should meet more of one group or the other, but just to have that awareness as you meet representatives from different groups.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. Tiana, I agree with staff's summary, and I think the guidance try to bring a discipline to the board. But I read the wording, actually, sometimes you mention the board needed to do something. Sometimes you mention the project team needed to do something. So I think maybe you should distinguish both more clearly what kind of work is discipline to the board, what kind of discipline to the project team, what kind of work both of project team and board get discipline. And the second comment was regarding to the part of understanding of what information stakeholders want and why. I agree that try to meet the users, private users' needs is crucial. But when I look at the wording from paragraph 27 to, I think, even later, 27 to 31, I think, yeah. It seemed that the wording a little bit different from this portion to the rest of the portion. For example, the wording here, quite strict and strong than others. For example, 27, it required the board need to obtain a deep understanding. And also, paragraph 28 also require, you know, the board to add the board develop a deep understanding, because other area just understanding. So I'm not sure whether you have specific requirements to the board. The board should have deep understanding those, you know, information needs of primary users. Also, paragraph 29, I think very strict requirements to the board. The second sentence said that the board needed to make sure that it understands all requests for disclosures in enough detail to develop and clearly articulate specific disclosure objective. I think I would like some more flexible, neutral word to the board in this regard. And also paragraph 38, you're using another wording with regard to understanding. 38A said that the board needs to fully understanding, so not only deep and also fully understanding. I think, yeah, so this kind of wording, I hope that we can use some kind of more flexible and not so strict word to the board, provide some flexibility for the board.
Also indicate when superficial understanding is in.
And also with regard to paragraph 30A, the third, with regard to the performance of field tests, I'm not sure at which stage the board should perform field tests. It seemed to me the field test at that stage a little bit earlier. Sometimes when we made a lot of decisions, and then we go out to reach out to do field tests based on our tentative decisions or proposals. So I would like to have field test at the late stage, not at earlier stage. Thank you.
I'm happy with the guidance as drafted in the state we are, that is to test what we're doing. So my comments are not necessary to be taken on board in the immediate future. You have in your paragraph 8, standing side to side, they shall consider disclosure and will normally. I read there that, in fact, you reflect the different tendencies that you heard from board members during board meeting, but I would want to make sure that this is what you reflect as a form of something that is, in a way, undecided, rather than considering them as equivalent, because to me they are just not equivalent. And so... also in the outreach to users, I think if we want to give ourselves a chance of making this work in the way intended, you really have to, you know, I agree with the list of questions that you have, but what I'm afraid of is that if the outreach is built on this list of questions, people are going to answer to the what, and they're not going to answer to the why. And so, and if it's the what, it's the what assessments do you need to make? Should be the first question. And what are the information which is necessary for these assessments? Because if you keep your question first, what information are you interested? I think we are not on the way of changing anything. And a small observation also, again, nothing of immediate importance or importance at all, by the way. In the notion of catch-all, I think I still have an issue with not necessarily fully understanding or grasping the difference we make between the catch-all at the level of a standard and the catch-all at the level of the whole financial statements. So having that, I have these doubts in my thinking. The point I wanted to make is, to me, at the level of a standard is not what makes sense to me. What makes sense to me is considering the transactions, a group of transactions, but a group of transactions may be the information that is presented may be the result of combined requirements from different standards. So I would like the focus to be on the group of transactions.
Anne? I agree with what you've presented here, and I think the guidance is useful. Talking about the method that you're using, Appendix B, I'm just wondering if you can give more clarity in relation to, excuse me, an evaluation of expected effects as opposed to an evaluation of effects after the implementation. So I think that's around step four and step five. So step four is about performing a cost-benefit analysis. So in there, I think what you're evaluating is expected effect. And then in step five, I think what you're evaluating is after application, where you're looking into what the effect was. Now, I might have read that wrongly, but I think you have to be clear about when you're talking about an expected effect and an actual outcome.
I think that's fair in terms of articulation. We possibly could have made that clearer. Just to sort of clarify a bit on those two points, perhaps. At the point of making decisions about disclosure objectives and requirements, we think it's key that effects are considered throughout the process, i.e. understanding what the expected effects are as part of the decision making. Step five we really felt was essential almost in a documented effects analysis sense at the very end of a project or amendment, so that all of the effects that have been considered as part of decision making are almost revisited and assessed in totality at the end, so we get a full understanding of what the effects would be and document that as part of finalising something. So we do see a distinction between the two.
But number five then is still an expected effects.
Yes.
When you talk about understanding the effects of the disclosure proposal, you're it's the potential effect, because you don't actually know at this stage.
Yes.
Yeah. I also had some other points about your section on taxonomy. Now, I think in this taxonomy section, it's really important to make it clear whether you're talking about a new standard or amendments to an existing standard, because the way the taxonomy team can contribute to the technical team varies. And I think in this text that we're working with, it's somewhat blurred. So in terms of what taxonomy team contributes, there's really two main areas. One is all the knowledge that they have about the standards and disclosure requirements across the standards. So a lot of cross-cutting requirements and their knowledge of how disclosures have been required in different standards and across time. And I think in your method, you are talking about accessing that information. So that's one thing where they contribute because they have a lot of knowledge about how we do standard setting for disclosure. And then quite separately, they also have a lot of knowledge of output when people apply the standards because they've done the common practice analysis. So they understand things about how disclosure requirements are used in practice. And that's quite a separate body of information and knowledge and experience that they have. So I think we have to be clear that they've got these two sets of information that can then contribute back to the process in the technical teams. Yeah?
Thank you. Very nice paper to read. One clarification on the hierarchy of these three objectives. One specific, another one is a high-level catch-all, the final one, overarching. So in the case raised in paragraph 12A, you suggested one example. In this case, it's no problem because specific disclosure objective, to meet that objective, you missed something based on that second high-level, high-level catch-all disclosure objectives. So additional disclosure might have no problem. But the other case, specific disclosure objective, you missed something. No, you did something. You did make some specific disclosure based on this specific disclosure objective. However, next one saying, no, you don't need this kind of disclosure. In that case, which objective you should respect? The entity should respect?
Okay. So the way that we envision this is that the specific objectives are what an entity will initially look at, and then the high level catch-all objective will prompt an entity to think about the specific topic in which they're disclosing. Is there anything else that might be useful to a primary user, to their specific primary users, that may not have been covered as part of our disclosure objectives and requirements already. So it's supposed to act as a prompt to make entities consider and step back. Have I disclosed what I need to disclose in order to meet the objectives?
That gets no problem. But for example, IFRS 15. Mm-hmm. If we just go to bottom the lower hierarchy of these three objectives. So to meet that specific disclosure objective, in the case of, for example, contract asset, so you should disclose something on the uncertainty of contract asset, for example. That's very specific disclosure objective. So you decide to disclose that item. But if you go to the next one, the more higher level, based on this higher level, there are other disclosure requirements already on other items. So based on this more helicopter view, you don't need this kind of disclosure on uncertainty of contract asset. So you don't need this one. This will obscure, in a sense. In that case, what objective you should respect?
So sorry, are we talking about a circumstance where we have a specific objective, but for a particular entity, the disclosure that would give would be immaterial? Is that?
Yeah.
In that case, it would be that materiality would be pervasive. So, the specific objective would still be the one that would lead to that disclosure if it was material. It's just that an entity would be applying materiality when it's looking at the objectives and requirements of a particular standard. And if something isn't material, then it wouldn't need to be disclosed. Does that
materiality might affect that this kind of a question, but in other cases, they still appear logically. I guess logically, the top objective is the most important one, right? They regard every disclosure requirements for an entity, right? Even though some specific disclosure objective might be too specific, so it might create some kind of unnecessary disclosures on an entity. In that case, based on this kind of example here, 12A, this is quite easy to answer. How about I'm suggesting another example that might have some kind of ambiguity on the hierarchy of this among these three objectives, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think we wouldn't necessarily regard some as being more important than others, because the way we see it is that each of the different types of objectives serve different purposes, and our goal is to communicate them in a way that would prompt entities to do different things with them. So as Siobhan described, they might look at the specific ones to think about specific user needs, and then look at the catch-all one to think about, is there anything else that hasn't been captured? So we wouldn't say that some are more or less important, more that they serve different purposes, but perhaps, thinking about how they turn into specific examples of objective and requirements is something we'll be thinking about as part of the testing, so it might be a discussion to revisit at a later date.
Tom?
Sorry. I apologize. I think this part could do a bit with a bit more context, fundamentally.
Which part, Tom?
Oh, I'm on Appendix A, just following up here. If I were at the standard setting stage, I'm just going to do the context in which I'm trying to look at this, I would have the order reversed. I think I hope everybody would, is we'd start with the overarching conceptual framework. We would come up with, we have the standard on X, here's the overarching disclosure objective within that standard, and then the specific ones would flow from the overall thing for the standard. And in fact, even in the way it's described here, when you've finished the specific, you're supposed to take a look at the overall and say, do we need to supplement? So the overall is kind of, even when we're looking at specific, it's sitting there. And so this, as it stands, is fine. That's the way you kind of walk through. But in reality, I think the overall standard one is actually sitting in people's minds, or ought to be, before they start the specifics. I think for two reasons. I think the specifics, since in the standard setting process, should have flowed from that. That makes sense to you, kind of remind people. And secondly, if you're going to apply materiality, it ought to be in the context of the standard to some degree, in which case you should be thinking about that overall standard objective when I make my materiality judgment on specific number one, specific number two, specific number three. So I'm happy with this, but I think we need a bit more context when we go to actually apply it.
Daryl?
So I have the same concern Tom had, and you won't be surprised at that. I raised it last time too. I had thought it felt just far more natural for me to start with the overall, then go into the specific, and then have a requirement towards the end that sort of points people back to the beginning again. That said, given the way we see in this document at the moment, which is as a draft document that we'll use over the process, I'm not unhappy with it going out or with us using it as it stands. And so what I might be doing is just putting down a marker to complain again later.
Tuck?
Thank you. I really appreciate your paper, especially I really appreciate about the other stakeholders. And I appreciate the list you raised here. But one question and two comments. One is about the commercial sensitivity. You didn't put it in the list. Is there any reason behind or just missed out?
I think our focus in making amendments was messages that had come through quite strongly from the various sources that we'd had. Yeah. That wasn't one that came through from sort of multiple sources, and we felt we had to put in it.
Yeah. To me, I think commercial sensitivity is one of the issues the especially preparer has a strong concern, even though they think it's very good information for the investors. But the information could be very good information for their competitors. So in that case, they don't really want to disclose it, even though they think it would be beneficial for them to disclose. So that's the difficulty the entity always face. So that's the issue we need to think about when we draft disclosures. So if possible, if you could include it, I would really appreciate. That's the first point. And the second point is relating to what Nick was talking about. This principle, this guidance would be applied to new standard as well. Yeah. So therefore, I have a slight concern with your paragraph 32 to 34. This is the supplementary disclosure for recognition and measurement. But the recognition and measurement is one of the communication tools to provide useful information to users. So you could do it either only disclosure, but if it's not possible to provide good information by only disclosure, then you might need to change the recognition and measurement. So it's one of the alternative, or nothing is supplemental to the other. Yeah. So therefore, I don't think you don't say that recognition comes first and disclosure will follow. But if we think this should be applied to new standard, first thing we have to think about is what the information user need, and what is the best way to provide that information. Then, if simple disclosure is fine, then fine. But unless you change the recognition and measurement, then you cannot provide good information. Then we need to consider changing the recognition and measurement. That's the second point. And the third point is about the cost-benefit analysis. I really appreciate you included cost-benefit analysis. However, I think we need some criteria for cost-benefit analysis. I don't mean to say that it should be a criteria, but we should list some points we should cover at the board table maybe most of the points was already mentioned in your paragraph 30 already, and especially if we include the commercial sensitivity, we can cover. But my concern about cost-benefit discussion at the board table is quite vague discussion. Some people say cost outweighed benefit, but some people say benefit outweighed cost. And there is no you know, equal comparative you know, standard, yeah, criteria. So that is the problem, especially beneficiary of disclosure and the cost bearer of disclosure are different people. So therefore, it's quite difficult to simply say that cost outweighed benefit. So therefore, we need to have some points to be covered, like commercial sensitivity or cost for system change or cost for changing day-to-day operation or the population of the entity who should be affected. So those things must be always covered. So if we could provide some kind of list, that would be very helpful for the future board discussion. Thank you.
So I'm happy. much happier than I was last time, so thank you. I think you did a good job of reflecting the comments that were raised. But I just had one question in terms of what we're going to be using this guidance for in the near term, and it's partly prompted by the comment that Nick made about old standards and new standards. So ultimately, we will hope that this will go well and we'll use this draft guidance for all of our standard setting to write good disclosure standards. But am I correct that in the near term, if we're using this draft guidance, so we use it for the testing for the two standards we've selected, obviously, but for other projects, so our new projects, for example, we will perhaps use the aspects of this, such as talking to people earlier on, involving the taxonomy staff, having a better understanding of what it is we want to get from disclosures and why people need the information. But at this point, we're not actually going so far as routinely drafting, using this new approach to drafting until we've tested it and we've got some more comfort that it's actually going to be, you know, operational, enforceable and all of that stuff.
Yes, that is a fair summary. Just to expand slightly, because we have, of course, discussed this with other teams that are working on standards at the moment, to the extent that other teams have, you know, been following what we've been doing and read all the papers and such, the feedback we've had is that there are elements of it that are proving useful as they think about disclosures and are leading them to think in a perhaps different way, which they are seeing benefits of. So it is being used to the extent that it's useful, but it is certainly not sort of required or being, you know, when other teams ask us, we're saying we're testing it at the moment. It's not something that other projects are expected to use, but we know that it is being used to the extent that it's happening.
Because the reason I'm flagging it and I'm looking at Neely as I say this is that I heard more feedback this week that the initial disclosures coming out of the new revenue standard and the new FI standards isn't getting much good disclosure out there into the market, and a concern that because we've reduced specificity, it might be having some not so great impacts in terms of the quality of what's being disclosed. So I'm just keen we keep monitoring that before we roll it out too broadly.
Mary?
Let me build on what Sue was saying. I think, first of all, again, compliments, and pretty good on the overall happiness scale. But given that that's a question you you asked, are we happy? And I think a lesson for us for other projects is kind of before we go to the next stage, it's very helpful to have all the discussions brought forward in a paper and we look at how they look as a whole before we start pushing ahead on things. So I think useful from that perspective as well. I think building on Sue's point, the paper really covers two categories of things. A lot of it is about process and us and our process, although there's some of it that it's it's about us and our process, but also our stakeholders. So I think we're going to have to communicate with stakeholders about how our expectations of them will be changing, so that we get, you know, so that we get that information earlier. Mm-hmm. But largely, what we're talking about, and I think we have to make sure we're making clear in our communications, it's about how we do things. And sometimes it gets hard to follow when we're talking about us versus not us, because what we are talking about is ultimately what kind of behaviors we want to change overall. So sometimes we're flipping back and forth a bit between what we're going to do and what impact we expect it to have on others. So I think we do have to communicate about what we're doing, that it's largely, to me, and this is what you're saying about picking it up in some current projects, the process improvements that you've identified here, I think are really good things that we can almost start moving on. Well, I think the testing is maybe more to the concern, both what would it look like when, you know, we look at the standards, but also testing what will we get in response to the redrafted standards. And that's when the testing is not just how would we write it, but how will those be applied in practice. And I'm reminded of a discussion that I think was run through the Interpretation Committee about 4 or 5 years ago, in which the Interpretation Committee was asked to look at all encouraged but not mandatory disclosures. And their feedback was, if it's encouraged but not mandatory, basically nobody does it. Either take them out or make them mandatory. But don't kid yourself. You don't feel better because you put it in as an encouragement. And I think we have to be realistic about that, and you know, taking things like our recent experience. And I think that comes down to drafting and things like, you know, you have two versions of language. An entity normally would, or an entity considers disclosing. And I think we'll have to think very carefully about which of those two formulations we use, because they could have very different outcomes. To Daryl's point, I too, in terms of our process, I think we say, okay, we have the conceptual framework objectives. We want to translate those versus an overarching objective to an objective for the standard. And then we have maybe more specific disclosure objectives. And then we get to writing. Once we've articulated those, we then get to writing disclosure requirements. I understand and agree with your objective of having a catch-all, but to me, and I think this may be what Daryl was saying, I think of it more as saying, having presented your overall objective, some specifics, and then illustrating how we think you get there, I then would just say, now stop and consider whether the package you've, you know, provided meets the overall disclosure objective, rather than saying, and now check this. Only, it's only when you get to the end that we tell you where you were supposed to be going to. I'd rather know at the front where I'm trying to get to, and then I can make assessments in that context. The last thing, it's maybe, again, a comment about how we communicate some of these things in talking about, I'm trying to find the section, the different stakeholders that we would talk with, and how we, what different views we'd expect to get put in. I think it's paragraph 28. It could be read as we see them as having competing or conflicting requirements. And I think, you know, one of the things that we spent some time articulating in the conceptual framework project is that there may be particular pieces of information that are used more by one type of user than another type of user, but we didn't identify any situation in which one group thought X was useful and the other group thought it was harmful. You know, there, what we didn't see, it's the, came up in the long-term investor category. So I think when we're talking about going to all these different stakeholders, we're talking about trying to get the kind of balance that Tak was speaking of, understanding how they use the information, whether it's only a limited group that uses it or more broadly, you know, what the costs are. But I don't think we're seeing them as being in conflict, for example, buy side versus sell side. They may have slightly somewhat different needs, but they're not, don't you dare have somebody disclose that because it will be a problem. I think Tak's citing of commercial sensitivity is maybe the only time we'll have the conflict that we're talking about. So I think it's just toning of how we communicate why we're talking to different groups and what we're trying to get from them. So some thoughts and reactions, but very helpful to have it recapped. Yes, I would prefer to flip around Appendix A to be in the other way. And remember that when we get to testing, we're trying to test that it will be effective. And I think we should start off with the stricter version, which is normally would disclose rather than shall consider disclosing.
I would like to react to the clarification that she asked would be made, that I think should be turned into a real decision and supported by an analysis, and probably not something that, as a result, we can really do today. But I think we have engaged on this disclosure initiative since 2011. One of the very strong comments that we received from many constituents on the disclosure initiative discussion paper was people calling for a standard level review. So now, if we really wanted to have changes in the why, in the relevance of disclosure that would be provided, we would change our standard setting requirements. I think we have, on that basis, done a good job of progressing through that draft guidance. And thank you to the team for bringing us where we are. And I think if we are around this table able to say we're happy with this guidance and we think that it's a good material in order to test on IFRS 13 and IAS 19, I think we are also in the agreement that the outcome of this test are exposed drafts that are going to be submitted to the public and eventually, depending on how the result that we get, we move into some changes. So if we are ready to go to a consultation phase on these two standards on the basis of the work that this guidance will lead us to do, I can't see why we cannot do the same for projects where there is a significant standard setting effort in terms of disclosures being made, whether it is an amendment or a new standard. And I think we have a good interest in doing that, because otherwise, if our test is a success, then if we have issued consultation documents with the old manner of doing things, if we want the disclosure be effective, we have to go to a second exposure draft because we would not have consulted on. So I think it's in terms of being convinced that we are working positively in the right direction, not applying this guidance to what we are doing in other projects is just contradicting ourselves and potentially a waste of time and money. So I really think that now the point of tension that I see, or the way I understand it, is really, in fact, what Mary has articulated, not feeling comfortable with having the requirement at the level of an objective and then a possible list of information. I think we can, in each of the consultation document that we have, we can ensure that we consult on both, on both articulations, so that we have consulted and we finally decide on the basis of the result of that consultation, and eventually this will have some constituent copying and pasting comments of the same type. But I really think that we have to make a formal decision as a group as to what we want to do with the other project. Personally, I would not feel comfortable, and I would not feel providing a good response to our constituents if we continue to work and issue disclosure requirements the way that has been done in the past. I think I would really feel we're missing something. In addition, I think that the discipline of having the objectives and the detailed information that may help fill the objective is for us an excellent discipline in justifying why the detailed information has been identified the way they have, and having a clear understanding of the role that it should play in fulfilling the needs of users. So I wouldn't want this to be just a clarification, you know, because we haven't, I don't think we have been in a position to really make a decision.
So I didn't think I was declaring it, and if you think I am, then of course I don't have the right to declare and impose it on the board, but every single time we've discussed the draft guidance, I've always said, can I please confirm this is for testing? And testing for me was always linked to IFRS 13 and IAS 19 now that we've chosen those two standards. If the board wants to do something differently, by all means, we can analyse that and vote on it. But I have to say that I'm really nervous, as I think I've been consistent in stating right from the start with this approach. I'm happy to test it and see what happens, but I've had numerous conversations with investors on the new standards, which are more objective-based than the old standards, and maybe we're not yet doing a great job in terms of specifying the objective, so maybe it's partly drafting. But my sense is that people aren't necessarily getting into the spirit of what we've wanted with the new approaches. And I've had conversations with firms and preparers on some of the things that we've brought in IFRS 7 in particular, where people are so focused on, where does it say I have to do that? I've never had one person go back to the objectives, link to the objectives that are in 7, and use them to read the words to help them interpret it if we haven't been, you know, completely black and white on a very specific example. I'm just, personally, I have no evidence that they're being used in the way that we hope they're going to be used. And I would love to be able to write them in an objective-based way if I thought it was going to work. But I think we have to be really careful overstretching in terms of pushing this approach until we're confident as a board that we're going to be doing something good for financial reporting when we do it. And I just don't have that confidence at the moment. Sure, if the board wants to discuss doing it more broadly, that's fine. But I think we need to be, personally, I think we need to be cautious. And if we do go out, my concern would be if we start going out with documents, exposure documents that are drafted only using this approach, we're going to have a re-exposure risk in the other direction if we decide that we need to do something more specific. So at a minimum, I think we'd need to have both versions and get feedback on both versions. But if we give preparers a choice which they think is a lighter choice, I can tell you which one they're going to say they prefer. And that's not necessarily going to be the best for us, ultimately.
Darryl?
I was going to come in on a similar point. Fortunately, I think we're probably in a position where we don't necessarily have a lot of new standard EDs lining up to go out at any minute with new disclosure. But I think we do have one that is getting fairly close, and that has looked to. And Catherine, the words you used was that the team had looked to and had discussed some of these. They weren't applying this word for word, but had gone through some of the process I've had one or two discussions with their team on the specific way that they're doing it. But I think the point that both Sue and Francois is raising is correct both ways. The problem is that we're going to have this one particular ED that's likely to land in let's call it the next 6 or 12 months. It is possibly going to have to reflect, it's going to have to reflect one or the other view as the primary thing. And whichever view it reflects, if we end up going the other way as a consequence of this exercise, we are going to have to deal with that problem. And that does suggest that I think we are going to probably, assuming that does need to go out before we have completed this exercise, and that seems likely, I think we are going to have to think about what additional measures we bring into the process. But I agree with what Francois is saying too, is that we've done a lot of work here. We spent a lot of time working on it. We need to at least have tried to reflect some of that in that exposure draft when the time comes. That was the one thing I wanted to just say. The other thing I wanted to pick up was the comment that Tuck made, which I completely agree with you that commercial sensitivity is a consideration that is happening in the background here. How did Mary express it? I'm on the happiness scale, largely happy with the document as it is. I'm incredibly nervous about you bringing commercial sensitivity in at this stage, because every time I've ever heard a preparer say commercial sensitivity is because they don't want to use it to see something. And it's typically the more commercially sensitive it is, the more interested the user is in the information. And it's something we can certainly think about as we go through the process. But bringing it into this document at this point in time just gives me the heebie-jeebs.
Martin.
And when I want to say the same as Sue, because when I have done all my voting in this project, I'm doing that because I was thinking we're doing testing and not really applying that for new standards already. Because when I also my understanding was the kind of testing is okay, that we maybe if we're doing all these changes from 19 and 13 and have an exposure draft, but me testing is also a little bit more. It is seeing how it is applied in practice then, maybe for at least 1 and 2 years before we finally decide if we're doing that. That was my understanding what we're doing in this project. And not that we agreeing on a good paper now and then saying that's it and then doing in the future based our disclosure requirements based on that. It is really important, I think, what was my understanding what we are doing in this project.
Amaru?
Well, just another component of the testing. I had the same perception as Martin, that we are developing something that I find, you know, the exercise very, very, very good in terms of testing. And I was a little bit surprised with expectations that we are going ahead with this for all projects from now on.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's what everybody said.
No, expectations, not really that we are going to do. So just to be clear to outsiders, what are we going to do and what is the time frame? Because if I'm hearing this discussion, not in this room, I might get the impression that we are going to apply this not only to these two that we are testing, but we might apply these to eventually exposure drafts. Okay. So two questions then. What is the real objective? Because the question is not here. What is the real objective of this, to be clear to outsiders? And what is the time frame for this testing? Because now Martin's expectation on testing is not only go to exposure draft to these two, but also follow up on the result. That makes a lot of sense, but is that what we are talking about?
Okay, I'm going to try and be concise. I've got potentially loads to say there. To be clear, for this entire process and every paper that we have brought to the board on this topic, that is based on an expectation that this is an approach for testing the two standards that have been selected and no other reason. Just to clarify my comments earlier on having spoken to other teams, what we have become aware of without this process sort of pushing itself onto other projects is that, you know, other teams are aware that this is going on, have read the papers and have found elements of what we are doing useful. And to the extent that they are useful, they have sort of kept them in mind when thinking about disclosures. And the feedback that we've had on the effect that that's had has been very positive. So I'm not going to say other than we are extremely pleased about that because we see it as a positive that it's proving useful in a process sense. But there is absolutely not an expectation or a requirement for anything other than the testing of IAS 19 and IFRS 13 to use this approach, and that's never been sort of part of what we are doing. The other thing you asked about was sort of timing and moving forward with that testing because of the potential impact that it, you know, could have on other projects. At risk of saying nothing good about my own project management skills, at the moment we haven't named an end date for that testing. The reason we have actively chosen not to name an end date is, in my mind, very, very linked to the risks that some of the board members have talked about in terms of the effectiveness of the method we're proposing. Because to my mind, getting objectives that are effective and specific is absolutely fundamental. It's the single most important thing in the project, and only if we achieve that will this approach work. If we can't do that, we fail. So I think that the first step of outreach and talking to investors and getting a complete understanding, and this may come down to the inadvertent strong language that Chin Chow mentioned in that section of the paper, is so fundamental that if we found that took, you know, a bit of time, I think that would be time well spent to thoroughly test to get to the point where we can either conclusively say, yes, we have a process where we can get to objectives that are so specific and so well drafted and so practically effective that we can make ourselves comfortable with the risks that Sue's identified, or test it thoroughly to the point where we go, you know what, actually, in the real world, this isn't going to work and we have to go down a different path. But we have actively chosen not to name an end date for that reason, but we are working on that right now. So I hope to update you soon.
Yeah, so just a follow-up on the testing. So in your mind, the testing concept does include what Martin understood, like not only exposing but following up the application during 1-2 years, or what's the testing concept?
So right at the moment, the things that we are doing now is firstly planning and working out an outreach program, which my personal dream is that the first stage will be a number of sort of one-to-ones with investors, as many as possible, to get almost the complete understanding of what they want. And my ideal second step will be some more open roundtables with multiple stakeholders to get balanced views on that, think about cost benefits, that kind of thing. We're also doing the stages of, for example, the taxonomy liaison that we can do at this early stage, although there'll be more of that once we've got proposals in mind. Once we have got through that objective identification piece, we then move into a place of, you know, discussing the outcome with the board and coming up with proposed requirements and drafting them, which again may take a period of months. And then of course there's the writing of an exposure draft and the feedback process on that exposure draft. So it is, you know, all of that is going to be a reasonable period of time. So it's, you know, this is not going to be done within a couple of months.
So sorry to insist on this, because it's still not clear to me what is the test concept in your mind is. Is the end of the exposure draft, or is the implementation of the proposal? Because that's what I understood from Martin. So in his mind, apparently, testing would include, well, is this working or not? And to assess if this is working or not, this would be 1 or 2 years after implementation date.
Okay, sorry. I think I've understood the question properly now.
So
to our mind, the testing would encompass everything I just described in terms of getting to an exposure draft, then publishing that exposure draft, both with proposed amendments to our two standards and an explanation of how the board got there, i.e. the process, and then all of the feedback we got from that. And we'd also hope to do, for example, field testing on the realities of applying the requirements that we would come up with. All of the feedback we got from that we would see as part of the testing. So to take an extreme example, if we were to publish an exposure draft with objectives-based disclosures, and you know, after the 6 months of feedback and comment and field work and all the rest of it, we discovered that actually it wasn't effective at all, having given the best shot we possibly can to objectives-based disclosures, then, you know, at that point we'd have to rethink. So that would be all part of testing. On the other hand, if we did that and that process of feedback and testing demonstrated that it did work, then that would be, you know, the point at which we would think about, you know, the next steps in terms of taking the guidance more broadly.
It's not going as far as it's become final. Now let's look at the actual financial statements and assess the results. She's talking about field testing. Yeah. Martin's asking whether we'd actually go so far as to call testing. Okay, we think it works through the comments and everything we get back in the field work. We do final requirements, then they go live, and then we look at the financial statements that come out, which is
a PIR type.
PIR type approach.
I mean, personally speaking, I think if we waited until, you know, we'd done ED, outcome of ED, final standard implemented, results of that, we'd be talking a lot of years. So personally, I aim and hope that we can get to a point where after ED, feedback from ED, you know, field testing, we could be confident in our ability to set effective objectives or not. But that would be the point at which
it's
I hope. Yes, I'm sorry.
I think it's good to be clear about the concept of testing we are talking about.
And for me, that is not testing.
Yeah, that's
the test is to see the result of our standards in practice, live people applying that, and what is the outcome. That is for me testing. Wishful thinking based on we giving kind of making an idea and people commenting on that, but have not demonstrated that it is really in practice in daily living working.
That's being told impairment provisions will increase by 50%.
It's different to testing because, man, even if you man look at this field testing in insurance, in impairments, it is all high-level something, but it's not testing in real world, and then the problems, are, is it working, is really after people have in practice using that for 1 or 2 years, and then we can finally judge, okay, does it work or doesn't it work?
I think what you're
I think the risk is if we're doing that only after we have exposed it and then changing all that, and if it is then not working, then we have an issue.
I mean,
that's
I think
what that's, I thought. Testing is okay. We are really fine, have tested it, and then we decide going forward, yeah. changing.
That's why, sorry to interrupt you, but that's why I think we on this table, we always, we ought to be clear about what we are talking about when it, we mention testing. Because what you described as what you have in mind and what Martin is describing, they are quite different.
Can I just add though that what we as staff would not do at this stage is say that, you know, we are definitely going to publish a final set of amendments that become mandatory for companies on the basis of this. We're at an extremely early stage. The only thing we can sort of be sort of planned tightly up to is the exposure draft stage, because we don't know what feedback we'll get from
that. Clearly, if we get negative feedback already in the exposure draft phase, and then maybe we stop testing and go back to the old world. But if we get positive feedback and saying, okay, should go ahead, still I think the testing is not ended. Then I think we need some more years in saying, okay, does it really work in practice? And then we can decide finally, okay, do we change how we drafting disclosure guidance standards?
Could I just make a couple of points here? I think Catherine's completely right. We're at such an early stage that it's very difficult to say exactly where this testing is going to end. It could end, we go out, we do the testing on the exposure drafts and discover actually it doesn't work, and so we stop at that point. We could decide that actually, based upon what we've done in testing on the two standards, we actually think, hey, this works really well, and we at that stage could take a decision that we want to expand it to new projects as well, but that would be a decision for that point. Whatever we decide at that point, we then have the additional thing of, if you like, a post-implementation review on the approach that we're taking to our disclosure requirements, and sort of say, well, actually, based upon what's actually happening in practice, are the changes that we actually need to make to this overall process. The great thing about this project is that what we're doing in terms of developing guidance for the board is not developing a due process document. We're developing internal materials for our use. So if, as a result of that post-implementation review, we come up with the point, oh, this needs changing, this needs some tweaks or something more fundamental, we could make that at that stage. It's something that's completely open to us to do. So what I would say is, let's not tie ourselves in too early to this. The basic point that this is for testing at this stage, I think, holds, and it is what we're looking at.
Mary? I was going to say before, just became a bit of a storm, that I think we may be over-amplifying the impact on the following basis. Remember that 80% of what we're talking about changing is our process, when we get the input. And you know, I think about one example of testing it was our discussions either July or June of rate regulation, when we were going through and certain things had been tagged with a star or something that said, basically, remember this when we get to the disclosure point. So that rather than waiting till we get to the end of the recognition and measurement, we were tagging things as we went along that we had to remember to think about, so we were kind of building up the list. So I think when it comes to what are we testing, we're testing that, and we're going to have to test how willing users are to give us the time, and whether, you know, from a cost benefit in terms of standard setting, the process, you know, works. But having done that, I think when we get to actually writing the requirements, there's going to be very, I think there'll be containable differences. And what I mean by that is having Daryl and I were looking at some of the same material, it does get to a pretty extensive list of what I'll call disclosure, I can't remember what, you know, what we call them, but specific disclosures, what you might call disclosure requirements. You know, and one question is, how do you introduce them? You know, that language we were talking about. But a second question that I think we could ask in whether it's the test cases and then thinking about this, don't up the risk of re-exposure whichever way you go, is saying, you know, we could ask ourselves, what more would we have to specify if we were writing old style versus new style in terms of the disclosures, if any, and ask people, you know, both A, if there's something more that we were writing if we were writing old style, and, you know, which they think would be more effective at eliciting the information, kind of a compare and contrast. And I think the impact on what we issue in terms of other standards is really limited in terms of, I mean, it's critical, and I don't want to just say, yes, we're moving to objectives and it's all done. I think when you see what objectives translates to in terms of, it's not just here are the objectives and go away, that you come up with a fairly comprehensive list of normally this wouldn't, you know, or something consider, or normally this would include doing the following things, then it's really a matter of how much requirement, you know, of an edge of requirement you put to it, and thinking about what would change. So I think we can control that piece, and most of it we don't have to torture ourselves about, because it's all of this is instructions to us about how to think better about disclosure requirements. And I think that applies no matter what.
The risk of us doing something very rash is pretty low, I would say.
So. Yeah.
Okay. Gary?
Rachel and Mary said much of what I was going to say is, I think, you know, the last couple of months we signed off on a series of process steps to test. And when you said it's going to be iterative, and I think at this point we think the board, everything said here is valid and relevant, but I think at this point we just let the staff go, because this is not a standards development. It is an tester of an internal process and should it change. And, you know, the best, you know, way to test if something works, at least my judgment, is to look back at something that's relevant, that you have empirical evidence and experience on, and apply it to it. But I do agree we should be clear, this is not a commitment to opening up all standards, not even a commitment to opening up these standards. It's using them as a good guinea pig. Is this a better way to write standards? I think at this point, I don't think we should try to micromanage it, just let the staff go on it and see what comes back. If it fails, well, failures is part of product development. You know, you go back to the drawing board a second time or a third time, and that's just, we said it's iterative, and to me, iterative, if it's iterative, means you didn't get there the first cycle through. So what you
okay,
come back with?
Let's try to round this up. Françoise, and then Daryl.
Well, I mean, when I listened to what you said about, you know, basically the question is, at what level should the requirement apply? I really think that this aspect comes into force, I mean, plays a role when we start consulting with a consultation document. So in any consultation document, we can have a question as to what is the level. We have an objective, we have detailed information that are likely to concur to the objective. We consult on at what level it should be. Should we say shall provide or shall consider or whatever. And so it's harmless. It is totally harmless to do that. At that stage, if we go that, we have not taken any risk with the quality of disclosures that people are going ultimately to provide. We just are following the guidance up to articulating objective detailed information, and we are asking people. So having every team working and doing a significant job on disclosures, following that guidance is first and foremost, as some have said, following a process, and a process that is very healthy for the quality of what we do. Then the tension point is at what level should the requirement be assessed, and that should be in the consultation document. I can't see why it is so important to keep our teams away from this, what I really believe would be an improvement. It may fail. It may fail partially. And we have in this guidance the possibility of having isolated, if we think that they're necessary and they're not linked to an object. We still, with this guidance, have the possibility of having detailed requirements by themselves. So I don't see how this can do any harm. So why do we stay away from it? I don't understand.
So?
I completely agree that we should be using the processes and involving taxonomy and talking to investors and talking about disclosures. So I agree with all of that part of the draft guidance and applying that routinely because I think it's just sensible. My only hesitation is on the drafting, and to me, I think there is risk, not necessarily harm, but risk, which I think is slightly different to your perspective, Françoise. And the risk I see is that I think that there's a real risk that we could go out with a set of proposals where we try the new approach, where we move sort of more routinely towards a shall consider, square brackets, that type of wording, shall consider, blah, blah, blah. People may well come back and say, yes, we think this is great. We think it's going to get a much better result. We say, great. We go out, and then all the financial statements that come back just don't have information in them. And when we say, why is there no information, they'll say, well, we've considered it, but it doesn't say we actually have to do it. And then the risk is we have to backtrack, yeah. And nobody's going to want to make that change. That's why I'm worried. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we can assess that until we see the financial statements. That's my concern. I don't think consultation in itself gives me the assurance. Now, I'm not saying that I object to trying it, but I'm nervous, so I'd rather try it in a more defined way, and that's why I care so much. What I think we can do is look at some of the feedback we get from the actual live examples we'll see of 9, 15, 16, which are not perfectly where you want to go, but in that direction, and see how good or bad they are. If they're not great, we then need to do some more work. Is it our words, or is it enforcement and all that sort of stuff? But it gives us an extra data point, and I'd just like to try and use as many of those data points as we can.
But then when the end of the testing comes with IFRS 13 and IAS 19, what are we going to do? Stop? Because we don't know how it's going to materialize in practice?
It depends what you think risk is better, doesn't it? Because I'd rather be cautious and go more slowly and be confident, or rather than take the chance that it's going to work.
Daryl?
Sincerely, I'm not sure we've got an awful lot of projects that are lining up to sort of hit the awkward spot here. So, and the other point I wanted to make, the document that Mary and I have been referring to obliquely is, in fact, in the public domain. I had a quick look to check. So it's an ASAF discussion document that is actually looking at specifically this. So I think a couple of things. So I agree completely with what everybody's saying about process, that we can benefit an awful lot from the process that's in the document. I think a second issue, though, that we are going to have to deal with given the conversation we've had, and it specifically relates then to the rate-regulated project, because that is the one that's likely to fall in this timeline, is what kind of briefing we think we should be giving to staff on what kind of direction we want to give to staff on that, because what we seem to be saying in the course of this discussion is we heard very, very strongly in the past that itemized disclosures cause disclosure overload. We are concluding that the most recent projects, May 15 and 9, may have a problem that people are under-interpreting what they're intended to do. Now, in many ways, what you're developing here is intended to bridge that gap, to try and get people to better understand what their objectives are. Now, I'm not entirely clear what we need to do now, given where we stand from. And it suggests that we need to take the lessons from what used to work about the old, what works with IFRS 9 and 15, which seems to be what you're doing anyway. So I suspect we're going to have to ask, and I don't think we can ask you to solve it. I think this is something we're going to have to solve when we talk specifically about the rate regulator disclosure requirements. But I think it is an issue we're going to have to deal with when it comes to that one. The one last comment I'd make is that I did not understand testing the way Martin did. I had assumed that this was going to be something working. And I would be quite cautious about thinking about that kind of long end. I think most people are looking to us to solve problems ideally earlier, given that we've had this project on our agenda for a while. And to the extent that we're identifying that 15 and 9 may have problems already now, the sooner we can solve them, the better. And the idea of going through a full cycle and PIR is certainly not what I had in mind. Now, to Rachel's point, I think we're going to have to see where we get to with the initial testing. But I certainly would hope that that's not where we're going to get to.
Tom?
Just, again, want to encourage staff to kind of carry on and emphasize, I think, a little bit what Gary said about it's an iterative process. We're learning, we're developing. And in particular, when I look at 44, which is the shall and the shall consider, or normally, and I agree, normally is going to be stronger, but I'm assuming staff are going to think really hard about how we operationalize the shall consider or normally and what advice we put around it and how auditors would react. And I think that's part of the iterative process Gary was referring to. So I have absolutely don't see in encouraging staff to go forward that we're locking into a dangerous shall consider at this point, if that's the dangerous one. I'm not saying it is. So I just kind of remember when, well, I won't do the analogy, but we should kind of just relax for a bit and let the staff kind of come back with the next step in this process. But I would be loath to stop the momentum.
Could I just say one thing? I promise it will be very short. I fear slightly that someone listening into this debate could take a slightly wrong impression, and I just wanted to highlight paragraph 8 in the paper, which gives the language that at this stage we have in mind. And the particular thing I wanted to highlight is the fact that what we are proposing is to put a clear shall with the specific objectives. It's not that what we are proposing would be shall consider only. Disclosing nothing would be a blatant non-compliance of the shall objectives if they are material. I just want to make that point because I just fear some of the discussion could be heard to mean that shall considers would be all there would be, and I wouldn't want that impression to be left.
Okay. Having heard all this, can we...
Can we confirm that we're happy?
Can we go ahead? Steph has had a lot of... Okay, let's take a break till 3:15.